Hi everyone, my name is Hadley Fisher and welcome to Resilience Agenda Radio. At Resilience Agenda, our big idea is mental fitness, the mindset, process and strategies you can use to develop, maintain and improve your mental health in an uncertain world.
So today I'm with Felice Jacka. Felice is a nutritional psychiatrist, one of the world's leading researchers on the impact of food on our health, the director of the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University, the author of the outstanding book Brain Changer, How Diet Can Save Your Mental Health, and one of the world's leading authorities on food and mental health. Felice joins us from Melbourne. How are you going?
Oh, good. It's great to talk to you. I should probably just clarify for people that I'm not actually a psychiatrist. I feel like a bit of a fraud. My background's in psychology and epidemiology, but I'm a professor of nutritional psychiatry research.
What exactly is nutritional psychiatry?
It's a good question. We study, certainly nutritional psychiatry research, we study the ways that diet interacts with mental and brain health. So we look at both prevention and treatment. So how might we prevent mental health problems starting in the first place? How might we treat them once they're already in place using nutritional strategies? And that primarily involves diet, but it can involve supplements. We certainly have a stream within our Food and Mood Centre that looks at different types of nutritional supplements, including, for example, probiotics and things like that.
First of all, tell us about yourself. How did you end up where you are? What's your journey as a researcher and now one of the world's leading authorities on food and mental health?
Very non-traditional, very circuitous. I went to many different primary schools. I went to many different high schools. I got expelled. I didn't even do year 12. I just went into fine art. My first degree was in fine art, and I was an artist in inverted commas. And but I always had a really strong interest in food and nutrition. And then I also had my own very powerful experience, and obviously it's very common as well, of having quite severe anxiety disorder and major depression throughout my, particularly my adolescence, which is, you know, when it affects a lot of people. Half of all mental disorders start before people are 14 years old. So with that background, by the time I was in my 30s, I decided I'd like to go back and study psychology. So I did do that, without a clear knowledge of what it was that I was wanting to do. But then I realised that I was really interested in sort of the research and the neuroscience aspect of things, and I went and found a psychiatry research unit that had just been established and offered to do some work experience while I was doing my psychology degree. I started doing that and just loved it, and very quickly got some funding and then went on from there to get a scholarship through Australian Rotary Health to do my PhD. And that PhD, at the time, I was considered to be a little bit out there, I think, in wanting to look at the possible role of nutrition in mental health. There was really nothing in psychiatry research around diet and mental health. And so there was a bit of skepticism. There was a bit of, you know, like, oh, God, that's a bit strange. But I went on and did that study, and that study ended up being very impactful. It was published on the front cover of the American Journal of Psychiatry. And because it was the first study to look at this, and we had very good measures. So, and from there, I kind of built my research career without any grand plan, but just with a real passion for wanting to improve things for people with mental health problems because of my own experience.
And we should give our good friends at Australian Rotary Health, John King and Greg Ross, a shout out. For those of you who don't know, Australian Rotary Health is a branch of Rotary who basically fund research around Australia. They've been doing this for a long time, and a lot of the medical research and mental health research in Australia gets funded by Australian Rotary Health. So it's really, really pleasing that Felice has gone from getting a scholarship to now being one of the experts, and we were able to support Australian Rotary Health last year.
You know, possibly the research that I've led has been enormously transformative and had a huge impact around the globe, and it's quite possible that it wouldn't have happened without that initial investment from Australian Rotary Health. And they've really been fundamental to a lot of the amazing research that's come out of Australia in mental health that just wouldn't have happened without their support.
We're going to go into this in detail over the next hour, but tell us, how does what we put into our mouths affect our mental health?
Well, where would you like to start? So there's three ways in which scientists, I guess, try and figure out what does what when it comes to health. One is we look at what we call epidemiology, and that's where you collect data from large groups of people by questionnaires and those sorts of things, and you use statistics to put them together. So in my case, I would look at people's diets, a big group of people, look at their diets in detail, look at their mental health, and it could be measured in multiple different ways, take into account all of those really key things that it could explain both. So things like people's education and income, or, you know, other health behaviours and those sorts of things. And then you use statistics to put things together to see what predicts what. But, of course, from that you can't demonstrate that something causes something else. It's only an association. The other thing that you do is you look at animals and you do animals experiments, because, of course, with the poor little animals, you know, I don't do this myself, I don't do any animal work, but, you know, they can chop their heads off and look inside their brains and figure out in great detail what mechanisms of action might be taking place. But the limitation there, of course, is that animals are not the same as humans. We can glean a lot, but not everything. And then the third area of research is to do clinical research, where you do a randomized controlled trial, where you allot people to one condition and another and compare them. Now, all of those types of research have their limitations, but it's important to really do research across all of those to understand how something might be working. And when it comes to nutrition and nutritional psychiatry, we've done a good decade now of really comprehensive research looking at the link between the quality of what people eat and their risk for what we call the common mental disorders, which is depression and anxiety. And all of this is in the larger context of poor diet now being the leading cause of illness and early death around the world, and that's because of the food and the way our food environment's changed, and mental disorders, particularly depression and anxiety, being the leading cause of global disability. So that's the context. So the fact that the two things are linked is really important. And over and over again, whether you look in Norway or Japan or Australia or any other country where we've done research and we look at people's diets and then we look at their mental health further down the track and we take into account all those other things, we see that the quality of our diets is linked to our mental health right across the age range, from right at the start of life right to the other end. From the animal research, we know that dietary components have a big impact on the brain plasticity, the gut, the immune system, stress response system, all of these systems that we know are involved in mental health. And then now, much more recently, we have randomised controlled trials such as our SMILES trial, which has been very influential. It's the first randomised controlled trial to try to evaluate whether if you helped people to improve their diet, would it have an impact on their mental health? And those were people with clinical depression. And we showed that, yes, it did. It had a very large impact. And now others have gone on and replicated that result. But we still are doing more and more research in that space. So across the board, we see in those three areas of research that diet matters to our mental health. We're expanding this now to look at other mental disorders such as schizophrenia. Certainly there's a lot of research happening in the Alzheimer's space, looking at the impact of, you know, what we eat on our brain as we aged, and we've done some work there as well. But, you know, more broadly, things like multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease and these types of conditions are also being increasingly linked to what we eat.
When we think about, or when we hear about health advice, it's often in the context of, you know, living longer or, you know, avoiding, you know, these diseases in the future. And, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, well, I'm fine pretty much, and these things are a long way off. But we're not just talking about mental disorders here. What we eat impacts how we feel. Even, and I suppose especially, if we don't have a diagnosed mental illness currently, we know that one in two people in their life may experience mental ill health, one in four are probably experiencing it at any one point in time. This message is addressed to everyone, not just those who have very poor mental health, and that's a big thing for us at Resilient Agenda, and we're going to go into that. But what is it about the idea of food impacting our mental health is so revolutionary and was so new when you researched it and so challenged the status quo?
I think in psychiatry there's always been this idea that somehow the head and the body aren't really connected, and, you know, that mental disorders all happen in the brain and then everything else happens in the body. And now, of course, we know that mental disorders, particularly when we talk about depression, they're whole body disorders. They involve all of the major systems, so particularly your immune system, but metabolic system and, you know, the gut-brain axis and these types of things. So that has limited research into the field. I think what also limited it a lot was a couple of things. One, there was a lot of really poor quality research done that kind of tarnished it, this idea. Secondly, it's around how people are trained, and in medicine and psychiatry, there's just not that training in nutrition and how it influences health. It's very much focused on, you know, medications and that sort of thing. And third, there was a lack of knowledge about how it is that diet might affect mental health. And so it's really only been in the last 20 years that we've understood that the immune system is really important in mental health. And, of course, this impact on the brain that we know from the animal studies, and increasingly now this new field, understanding how important the gut is for every aspect of our health, including brain and behaviour. And all of these things are very strongly influenced by diet and the diet that we eat. Now, if you say to people, and this is one of the problems with focusing on obesity, which is where the public health messaging is, if you say, you know, you've got to eat well because otherwise you're going to have a heart attack further down the road or cancer or something, that's off in the distance. It just doesn't cut through. If you make it all about a body weight, what happens is people try to lose weight, and well, they might be successful, but almost invariably they'll put it back on again, or they can't lose weight at all. And so they give up. They think, well, I might as well just keep on eating the burgers because I can't get anywhere. The new knowledge that nutrition affects our mental and brain health really very quickly, and we think at least partly through the gut, and that can have an impact on the gut within hours, it gives people something much more concrete. It really leverages behaviour change because it becomes immediately salient. As you say, everybody has a brain, everyone has mental health of some sort, and everybody eats several times a day, 100% of the population. So it's relevant to everyone. And I think the final thing is, and this is what's most powerful, if we think about the risk factors for mental health problems, they're very often things that are very difficult to change. So they're our genetics, early life trauma, life stress, poverty and disadvantage. All of these are really important in increasing our risk of mental disorders. It's only more recently that we've come to understand that there are modifiable things that you can change to increase your resilience, to reduce your risk, or if you do have a condition already, to reduce the impact and to improve your condition. And that is those basics. It's diet, it's exercise, it's sleep, it's not smoking. So just today, for example, I worked on a big team on a huge what we call a meta review of what we are now calling lifestyle psychiatry. And it just shows all of those things are important in the risk for mental disorders, but also in the treatment. And one of the really fascinating things that came out of that from crunching all the numbers is that if people smoke cigarettes, they're twice as likely to develop a mental disorder. Now, I need to go back and check that, whether it's just relates to depression or more broadly, but understanding that cigarettes increase the risk for mental disorder, in the past that would have always been thought of as reverse causality. People with mental disorders smoke a lot more. We know that. But these data, very rigorous data from genetic studies as well as other different sorts of studies, tell us that no, it works the other way around as well. And that's because it's not just about our brain, it's about our whole body. And if you support the health of your whole body through those fundamental things that we know the body needs to thrive, then you increase your resilience. And it helps support if you go on and have other treatments, psychotherapy, pharmacology, anything else. It gives the foundation for all of those things. Great. And that's why it's so powerful.
You talk about in your book about the different reasons why we might like to eat well. And I think having this why is really important. We talked about losing weight or not being obese as one why. There's another one of not getting cancer or diabetes in old age. Another one that you mention in the book is you can eat well in order to be reproductively successful. And I suppose another one is you can eat well for mental health. And like you said, it's salient. And you know, you might have people who have tried losing weight and then sort of accepted that they haven't succeeded. And then they've sort of given up on healthy eating. But now what we're doing with this is we're saying, well, here's another reason for you to give it a go. And you might be able to see some shorter changes a bit more quickly. If we can promote that message, even if it's only successful for a few people, it's going to make a difference.
Well, I think that's really powerful for people to understand, is that the quality of what they eat is really important for their health, quite independent of their body weight. As a perfect concrete example, with our SMILES trial, which was the first randomized controlled trial to take people with moderate to severe clinical depression, these people weren't just mildly ill, they were very unwell, and we randomly assigned them to get either support from a dietitian or what we call social support for 3 months. And the dietitian worked with the people in their group to help them to make those positive changes to their diet, to increase the intake of healthful foods, to reduce the intake of junk and processed foods. And what we saw was a really very striking result, where the people who got the dietary support, it had a very, very pronounced improvement in their depressive symptoms. And the more they improved their diet, the better off they were. We found that it was very cost-effective. We found that our diet was less expensive than the one people had when they came into the study. So there were all these great things that came out of it. People's anxiety levels also improved. But I think one of the key findings was that the average BMI of people within the study was 30, around about 30, and that didn't change. People's weight didn't change, and yet they experienced a massive benefit. And when we look at all the epidemiology data, we see that there's this link between diet quality and the risk for common mental disorders, depression in particular, that is quite independent of body weight. So that's a powerful message. It's not about your body weight. If you focus on improving your diet quality to feed your gut, feed your brain, feed your immune system, and you move and you sleep and you do all the things that help your body, you'll experience a great benefit whether or not your weight changes.
Let's talk about gut health for a moment and its emerging impact on mental health. You write in your book, "The gut microbiota is having as much of an impact on medical research as the discovery of very small particles did on the field of physics early last century." That's a big call. A lot of people might have recognised that gut health is a bit of a fad or a trend these days, with kombucha or vinegar or kimchi. What have you found? Is there evidence to it? And what's the truth?
Look, I think it's really fascinating, and I think everyone's very intrigued because, and it's a very complex field, and it's not going to be easy for me to make it extremely succinct, but I could give you a few key examples that I think underline the power of this particular field. If you take this one cool example, if you take poo from someone with clinical depression or someone with schizophrenia, put it into an animal, so a mouse or rat, and you also do the same with poo from a healthy person, the rats or the mice that get the poo from the person with major depression or schizophrenia develop the phenotype of that condition. That means that they start behaving like they're depressed or they have schizophrenia, and they have a whole lot of biochemical changes that you see in humans with that. So that's one very cool insight. Another area, and I mean, it is complicated. A lot of what we know so far is coming from animals, so we certainly need more data from humans, certainly around the psychiatric stuff, but we already know that probiotics seem to help anxiety and depression. We have data from clinical trials for that. But it's very complex when you think about microbiology is complex, the methods are complex, the bioinformatics that you need to analyse the data are complex. What's simple, though, is that what we know about the bugs that live in our gut is that you need to feed them, and you need to feed them fibre and polyphenols, which are key components of plant foods, and then they can do all the stuff that we know that they need to do. So they produce all these many, many, many metabolites, including neurotransmitters, that influence the way our genes express themselves, our immune system, our body weight, and our brain and behaviour. Where I think we're seeing some of the most exciting findings, and this is why I think it's so cool, because we're extending now beyond the animal research to humans, is in the area of cancer treatment. And we're seeing in humans really, really compelling data that the degree to which people respond to things like these new immunotherapies seems to be very much dependent on their gut microbiota. So just as one example, when people were receiving immunotherapy, those that received antibiotics within a month or so of the immunotherapy twice as likely to die and to not have that survival outcome. The gut seems to be really central, and this is not from animal studies, this is from human studies, that more diverse people with more diversity of microbiota in their guts have much better outcomes from cancer treatment.
Fantastic.
Now, that is concordant with what we know from all these other areas of health research, where the diversity, a healthy gut seems to be a real marker of health and resilience. How do you get a healthy gut diversity? You eat a diverse range of plant foods. You eat fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, whole grain cereals, very importantly, legumes, you know, lentils and chickpeas and beans and all the rest of it, and you really mix it up. So you get more of those foods that have got the fibre and the polyphenols that feed the gut bacteria, and you get more diversity, so you get more bugs, more different types of bugs, and you're helping the healthy populations. So whilst all the other stuff is really complicated, that's actually a pretty simple message and something that people can put into action straight away, and it will start to affect what your gut microbiota do within hours.
We're going to talk about some of those food details shortly, but you mentioned in your book that constipation, bloating and diarrhea are three of the common symptoms of poor gut health and potentially risk factors for depression. You know, the things that are kryptonite for your gut health. Now, you've mentioned antibiotics. Now, when you need antibiotics, you need antibiotics. But, you know, if you don't need them, you don't
and
need them.
And it's not all bad. Yeah. Really interestingly, you know, in some cases antibiotics can actually knock out the bad bugs and help the good bugs to thrive. So we still need a lot more information there. What's hugely problematic is the overuse of antibiotics and the fact that they're right through our food chain, and I suspect that that's also been a player in the obesity epidemic.
If a person's listening to this and they notice, you know, constipation, bloating, diarrhea, and let's say, you know, they don't think it's quite serious enough to go to their doctor just yet, what can they do? You know, what kind of foods can they think about avoiding in the first instance or reducing?
It's pretty tricky because it's a chicken and egg thing. So what we see very commonly is a lot of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, very common. Part of that seems to be related to mental health. So people who are more anxious or depressed will have more likely to have IBS. And that's because there's this bi-directional relationship between the gut and the brain. They talk to each other all the time and each influences the other. With IBS, though, and with a lot of people, what you see is that they have a less strong, less diverse, potentially healthy microbiota. And that makes it more difficult to break down the gut foods. So the gut foods are these things called FODMAPs. You would have heard about FODMAPs before. They are key foods for the bacteria. But if your bacteria are not quite up to speed or doing what they're supposed to do, you can't actually manage them. You can't break them down, and then you get a grisly gut. So dealing with that is quite difficult, and we're still very much in the stage of doing research to try and figure it out. But I, for example, have one of the world's leading experts on IBS research in my team, Dr. Heidi Studaker, and she's done a lot of work to show that, yes, a low FODMAP diet helps people with IBS, but it also has a negative impact on the gut. It reduces the bacteria that produce these short-chain fatty acids that we know are really, really helpful for all sorts of things. But then she's done further research to show that if you add in probiotics, you can, to some extent, mitigate that. And one of my team is doing a lot of work in this space. She said the answer to a problem with beans is actually more beans. That over time you might gradually, so you might take them out of your diet for a period of 6 weeks or something and then gradually introduce them back in again with probiotics, with some fermented foods. That's what we're thinking at the moment might be helpful, but we still don't have enough research to say for sure. There's a wonderful woman called Megan Rossi, who's the gut health doctor on Instagram and Twitter. She did a PhD with Heidi. She's actually an Australian as well. She's very well known. She's got a terrific book. So if people are in that situation, it might be worth them having a look at that, The Gut Health Doctor.
Wonderful. Thank you. Let's now get into the nub of it, the practical stuff. There's all sorts of different diets out there. There's Atkins diet, there's paleo diet, there's keto diets, there's vegan diets, whatever it might be. And then there's all sorts of different things. But you've discovered the ideal eating plan for mental health, and that's the Mediterranean diet. Tell us about what that is and what it involves. Mm-hmm.
First of all, I should probably backtrack a little bit and say that the Mediterranean diet is certainly the diet that's been a Mediterranean-style diet, because the Mediterranean diet these days can look very, very different. Different parts of the Mediterranean, also even the Mediterranean is becoming a lot more Western. But a traditional Mediterranean diet is the one we're talking about. That is incredibly well studied, and we know that it is the optimal diet for virtually every health outcome you can think of, from heart disease to cancer to diabetes to everything. It's also the best one for the environment as well. But when we look at the literature around diet and mental health, traditional diets from all over the world are linked to better mental health. So it might be a traditional Norwegian diet, which is really high in brassicas and, you know, fish and those sorts of things. A traditional Japanese diet, high in fish and certain types of veggies and some fermented foods, soybeans, things like that. So traditional diets everywhere tend to be good diets. They're good diets for your health and for your mental health. So I don't think there's just one type, and people can have can be vegetarian, they can be vegan, they can be omnivores, and they can still have a healthful diet. But really, for gut health and for brain health, there'd be two or three key components. One is your plant foods, increasing the quantity and the diversity, and the other is avoiding the junk and processed foods. Now, most of what we know about the detrimental impact of junk and processed foods comes from animal studies, and that's for the very good reason that it's very difficult to get ethics approval or to get people to agree to be put on a junk food diet for any length of time. So that's a problem for research. Has been done once. We're planning more studies in this space, but generally you have to look to animals to understand that. And when we look at the animal research, we know that high blood glucose affects the lining of the gut, which is problematic for a whole host of reasons. We see that emulsifiers that you find in processed foods are also the same. We see that saturated fats, animal fats, are also the same. We see that animal proteins in excess are also the same. And we see that salt is also problematic. So you can see why a Western diet, which is very high in animal fats and proteins, added salts, added sugars, refined carbohydrates, why it's notoriously bad for health, and why a traditional Mediterranean diet, which is very high in a very diverse range of plant foods, and it has small amounts of meat, fish, small amounts of fermented dairy, it has nuts and seeds, and it has lots of beans, lots of legumes, this is a really great diet for health.
The common factor with Norway, Japan, and Mediterranean is they're all very seafood-based, so you know, they're near the sea. You can get seafood easily. In Australia, it you know, it should be pretty much the same sort of thing. But what we find, and I'm interested in what you think of this, you know, seafood, especially fresh seafood, is pretty expensive. On the, you know, on the other hand, you've got people, you know, a lot of people from say India or China or other countries or Africa in Australia that may not be familiar with their traditional diets is the way that, say, people from different cultural backgrounds and the way they eat, is it just a matter of adapting those diets to, you know, what is healthier, or is it a misnomer to say that, well, Indian or Chinese isn't healthy because they use vegetable oils, for example? Does that make a difference?
I think it's a misnomer because according to the data, you know, traditional diets all over the world are associated with much greater health benefits, and some of those will be from people who live far inland and don't have any fish whatsoever. And certainly traditional Australian diets tend to not have a lot of fish, and we still see that they're very clearly associated with better mental health outcomes as well as physical health outcomes. So for me, I think there's a wide latitude for what you can include and not include in the diet, but the key things are that fibre and plant foods. So as Michael Pollan said, eat whole foods, not too much, mostly plants. And that's why I always say it's actually quite simple. What's the challenge, though, is the food environment, which is the foods are designed to interact with all the reward systems in our brain, just like drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, etc. And we have them everywhere we go, whether we go to fill up our car with petrol or whether we're going just up to the high street to pay a bill or whatever it is. There are signals that interact with the reward systems of our brain, a bit like a crack cocaine den on every corner, trying to lure us in. And then we have the situation where they are allowed to advertise everywhere, on the television, on the radio, they sponsor sporting events. So we cannot escape the food environment, and we know it's the food environment that is the primary driver of our food behaviour. So avoiding these foods that we know are so toxic to our brain, to our gut, to our health, it's very, very difficult, and this is why I always argue so strongly for food policy.
In your book, you talk a lot about what you eat at home, but I suppose there's this other side of food, and especially for Victorians and Melburnians who love their food culture in particular, there's two big trends, certainly not during lockdown, but there's two big trends that maybe even making the situation more challenging for people like you who are trying to encourage people to eat better. One is the culture of eating out in restaurants, and you know what you eat is not always healthy. Portion sizes are large. You know, it's quite rich food, and I'd be interested in what you have to say about that side of things. But then the other side of things is, and I'm personally, I think it's a bit of a scourge, the delivery culture that's taking off at the moment. You don't even go and get your takeaway food anymore. It just comes to you, and this is becoming a habit. And you talk about you know, the lack of cooking skills and preparation skills. You can't expect Uber Eats or Deliveroo to deliver you a great salad, for example. What do you make of those two ideas in addition to your concerns about big food and the food environment?
Well, we know, for example, that I think the majority of meals eaten in the US are takeout meals. They're not actually prepared at home. And in Australia, it's not quite so extreme, but certainly it's getting that way. There's a very big difference to eating out in a great inner city restaurant where you'll get fantastic whole grain sourdough bread with gorgeous smashed avocados and organic eggs and lots of greenery on the plate compared to Macca's. I mean, there's a world of difference. So you can certainly have takeout food that is great quality. And, I mean, if I'm going to do takeout, it is, you know, almost invariably Indian. I love Indian dals and, you know, vegetarian takeout or Japanese, for example, I really like. So there's a huge divergence there. But I guess what I worry about is when we start getting people can get very, very hung up on the details and like, oh, if it's not organic, then, you know, I'm just going to keel over and cark it from a cancer immediately. You know, the issue is much bigger than that because we know that in Australia, only about 5% of adults adhere to the dietary guidelines. So 5%, that means 95% of people don't get their basic whole grain cereals, fruits, vegetables, the way that, you know, the recommendations exist. Even worse, less than 0.5% of children in Australia get their recommended intake of vegetables and legumes. Less than 0.5%. So this is not just for people who are disadvantaged or maybe don't have access to means or education. This is everyone. In Australia, the average number of serves of discretionary food, which is, you know, less helpful junk food, that for Australian teenagers, it's seven a day. Seven a day, not a week, a day. So that to me, certainly Uber Eats and the home delivery and everything just exacerbates that. It just facilitates it. But even without that, that massive problem is there because of the food environment.
And I suppose a lot of people link food consumption to weight gain again. And if your kids aren't, I mean, kids are becoming obese, but if your kids aren't becoming obese, you might think, what's the problem with those seven servings a day? But the point of your research and what we're trying to explain here is there's this mental health side, part of which is visible in terms of behaviour, but another part is less visible, which is the internal experience of the person. And we know that, you know, rates of youth mental ill health are reportedly on the rise. And so that's possibly a big factor. What can parents do? You know, that goes a bit deeper than just, you know, eat your carrots. What can parents do to create a better food environment at home at least? That's the part you probably can have some degree of control over. What can parents do?
Well, it's tricky because it gets back to what can parents actually do if they don't have the education or the knowledge themselves. You know, if it's become so normalised to eat foods that come out of a packet and people have forgotten how to prepare fresh foods, then how can you create an environment at home where healthful foods are the norm? I mean, in the book I talk about what I do and basically the sort of pantry overhaul, but that could be a bit extreme for a lot of people. Certainly there's the basic things like getting kids exposed to the taste of vegetables right from the start. You know, there's a good argument for giving kids the difficult-tasting vegetables almost as their first foods because then they get used to it straight away. You don't give them the sweet fruits and things like that or the horrible rice cereals, which are just pure starch. You give them, you know, broccoli, or you give them something that is more challenging taste, because over six exposures, they will get used to those flavours and their brain will adapt to them. You make it simple for kids to have healthful foods. You just don't have the crap in the house, then it's not an option. You get kids helping you to prepare foods from the first go. It can be very, very simple. I've just published a book last month called There's a Zoo in My Poo, and it's directly designed to address this, because kids, when they understand something and it's made concrete for them and not vague, like, oh, don't eat, that's not good for you, or this is good for you, make it really concrete and say, you've got a zoo living in your poo and you have to feed it. You're the zookeeper. This is up to you. And this is what your zoo likes, and this is what will be really bad for your zoo. And I got my husband, who's wonderful illustrator, to do the drawings of all these bugs. And the idea is that it gives kids their own power. I wrote a few really basic recipes at the end, like zoo poo stew and better bog burgers, things that kids will respond to, and it's full of all the things that kids find fun. And the idea, though, is that the kids actually almost teach the parents, because the parents are the ones that are the problem these days. They've forgotten how to do this. But then again, I think it's really problematic where particularly on the right, people are saying, this is all your responsibility. You haven't eaten right. You're making the wrong choices. And even worse, oh, if you've got a mental health problem, that's your fault. You ate junk food and didn't exercise. That to me is just mind-boggling, because you've got to make the environment one that supports healthy choices. And at the moment, these highly ultra-processed junk and processed foods are the most accessible, the most heavily marketed, the cheapest, and therefore the most socially acceptable and the most consumed foods. So without policy to change that situation, you're really fighting an uphill battle. But if kids know this information and it's concrete to them, then they do respond. And that's what we're finding, is that kids are really responding to this book, which is what we hoped.
What do you make of the commonly accepted idea that supermarket food should be cheap? And this idea that Coles putting their prices down, fresh foods are too expensive, therefore I'll buy what's cheap. At the same time, people pay $4.50 for a coffee or $15 for a cocktail. And of course, there are different, you know, socioeconomic groups in play here. So I don't want to play down financial challenges. But what are your thoughts on fresh food and how we prepare it, sell it, subsidize it? Have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, something like 70 of the top 100 biggest companies in the world make these ultra-processed food products, and they're making huge profits at the expense of our health and the environment. So the industrialised food system at the moment is costing the planet, and we're talking here health and the environment, something like $12 trillion a year, and it will be $16 trillion by 2050, which is the equivalent of the GDP of China every year. And then the companies are making these profits, taking them, and we're left with the bill. So this kind of just does my head in. And, of course, this is why public health experts love the idea of some taxes and incentives. So where you tax the really ultra-processed food products and then go and subsidise the whole foods and the primary producers. What I'm loving during COVID is this move towards getting their food from farmers' markets. You cut out the supermarkets, you just go straight to the source and you get your fruit and veggie delivered, you get it from the farmer's market, whatever. I really hope to see more and more of that. But advertisers don't spend billions of dollars a year on advertising junk food because it doesn't work. It works really, really well. So until we restrict their ability to do that and until we support more our primary producers and try and make these ultra-processed foods more expensive and less accessible, it's an uphill battle.
Yep. You talk about the story of the man who changed his diet overnight in your book and within 3 days was feeling better. Tell us about this guy, the changes he made, what the keys to success here were for this guy.
I often get people just from the general public just emailing me randomly and saying, you know, I read your book or I read your research and I did this thing. And he was one of them, and I got back to him and said, would you mind if I use this story in my book? So I've got a few of those throughout just to make it more real for people. And he was, you know, very typical, I think, of people as they get older. You just get exhausted, you know, you're overworked and you're stressed and you reward yourself with nice foods that, you know, make you feel happy in the short term. And your weight and your health suffer as a result. And he got to a real low point and decided to transform it all. And then he found a really massive improvement to his health and mental health within a very short space of time. And I hear that story over and over and over again. One of the women in the SMILES trial who received the dietary intervention, she's actually been in the media quite a lot after this, and she's very typical too, I think, and I talk about her experience a lot. She was living on coffee, wine and cigarettes with very severe chronic major depressive disorder, very high doses of antidepressant medications. She came to us as a last resort, and she says, "This changed my life going into the SMILES trial." And this is what we find is that people, when they're supported to make gradual changes in one area of their life, it starts to flow into other areas. So she started to improve her diet and she started to feel better. So she gradually reduced then the amount of wine and coffee and cigarettes that she was having, and then she actually gave up smoking. And then she started to increase her exercise. She started going for walks with friends. Then she started hiking. Then, you know, all of these things in her life changed. And she's gradually over time been able to really improve her health and her mental health and reduce a lot of the other things that she was using to self-medicate. So that is a story that I hear over and over again from people. And it's really powerful because I think people love the fact that, yes, there might be all these terrible things happening in their life and in the wider world that can make us all depressed and anxious. I mean, one of my PhD students is a psychiatrist and she said, "Why wouldn't you be depressed? You know, the world is a kind of crazy place that can be very, very challenging. But if you feel that you've got the power to make those small changes yourself, and even if you just do them very gradually, I would suggest that the research says get help from a professional, go and see a dietitian. But you have the power in your own hands to make very large changes to your health.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting, I think.
I agree, and it's something that, you know, we can talk about now. And I really love the way you've divided it up, that there are three elements to eating well. One is shopping, one is preparing, and one is the actual process of eating. And I love the way you cover the full gamut there. In my own life, we make lists now rather than just going and picking things off the shelves, and we do meal plans and we shop for them. And I shop better and healthier when I do that rather than just, "Oh, I could do with that." That's the first thing. Around preparing food, I remember back in the day, you know, back when I was a young guy, you'd always hear this advice around eat more vegetables, eat more legumes. And, you know, I remember, you know, vegetables as a child for me were boiled, unsalted, unseasoned.
You know, me too.
That was really food. That was food. I didn't know what a legume was and had no motivation to find out. And the other seeds, and I don't want to eat rabbit food, and lettuce was for rabbits, for birds and rabbits. And so I quickly forgot all this advice. But what I love about your book, and I think what we can do more of, is we don't eat nutrients, we eat foods, and foods come together. For example, we often think about foods in terms of cuisines. Oh, I think about, I'd love to eat Mexican tonight. And when I'm thinking about Mexican, I'm thinking about beans. I feel like eating Indian tonight. That's lentils and chickpeas. And that's the first part of it. And the second part was just, this was about 10 or 15 years ago, when I learned to use herbs and spices. A basic understanding of herbs and spices, I think, is an essential thing for learning how to love vegetables, because, yeah, vegetables can be boring if there's no flavor on them. But if you know how to flavor them, they're incredible. And you pay $20 for that at an Indian takeaway.
And even better, the herbs and the spices have so much bang for their buck in terms of not just nutrients. You know, I think we talked about minerals and vitamins in the past, but it's so much more than that. There are just thousands of compounds in plants that we're only just starting to map. And each of them do really powerful things. And the things that you get in fresh fruit, spices and herbs and things are just so powerful. You grab a handful of coriander or parsley and add it to whatever you're eating, you're immediately really having a substantial impact on the quality of the meal that you've just eaten. But, you know, I'm extremely busy and don't have time. I love cooking on the weekend, getting a recipe out and, you know, doing a bit of a cook as a creative process. But generally I don't have time for that. So I make it super, super simple. Just for an example, last night, you know, we make this really super simple cauliflower soup. And you get a cauliflower and you get a tin of cannellini beans, or you can have any beans. I think we just used four bean mix last night because that's what we have. And some stock and a bit of parmesan, and you blend it all up. Like, you cook it and blend it up. That's it. And that is just so full of goodness. And then you add some fresh parsley from a pot on top, and some pepper. And for me, I add some, you know, sourdough rye piece of toast. So simple, so quick, so cheap, really, and so enjoyable. And similarly, you know, I think about food like a peasant diet. The best diet is a peasant diet. So it's beans, and they can be dried, they can be tinned. It's really dark whole grain cereals, so your oats and your whole grain breads and buckwheat and barley. You know, we used to put barley in soup all the time. Fantastic grain. Peasant food. It can be inexpensive and super, super easy to prepare. And so in the book, there's a few recipes there, but I generally don't follow recipes. I just do really simple stuff that's very quick and has a lot of bang for its buck.
Let's talk about carbs for a minute. In your book, and I learned a lot from this, you say that carbs aren't the enemy, where for a lot of people who are trying to be health conscious these days, carbs are the enemy. A lot of people don't realize that carbs go beyond just pasta and rice. There's also carbs in vegetables. But you make the key distinction that there's two types of carbs, really, or two types of grains. There's whole grains and then there's processed grains. And you describe the history of the food pyramid, how grains became recommended, but somewhere along the line, big food and taste and convenience made white grains the default choice rather than whole grains. Can you talk us through that distinction about why carbs are not the enemy, especially for mental health?
Oh, I just don't even know where to start here. That myth is, it just does my head in. It came out of America, as a lot of the really, really toxic nutrition information, and that's in inverted commas, comes out of the States, where they have so many generations of non-food that it's normal to them. They've forgotten what a whole grain even is. You know, their whole grain would not be a whole grain. It would be something very, very refined. And so these nutrition influencers and GPs, very often they're MDs, they would promote these taking carbs out of the diet. For them, carbs is like bad because it's all the sweet things. It's donuts and pastries and cakes and bread and all of these things. They're just all called carbs. And if we take them out of our diet, we'll lose weight and then we'll be healthier. Well, yes, if your carbs are those things and you remove them out of the diet, yes, you will be better off. But carbohydrates are actually the key for bacteria, for what they need to eat. If you look at all of the research that's been done across the world, the food group that has the strongest association with health outcomes, better health outcomes, is actually whole grain cereals, more even than vegetables. And that's because the fiber that's in those whole grains is gut bacteria food. That is what the gut bacteria ferment. So if you think about the gut bacteria, what are they there for mainly? Well, from the point of view of food, they're there to break down the bits of food that our human enzymes can't. And that is fiber, which is complex carbohydrate, and polyphenols, which are also found within the food matrix of those foods that have high levels of fiber in them. And the bacteria break them down, and in the process, they release, as I said, all of these metabolites that have all these huge impact on our immune system, our brain, our body weight, our metabolism, the ways our genes express themselves. If you don't feed your bugs that fibre and those complex carbohydrates, they can't do what they do. Now, numerous studies in humans have shown that when you increase the whole grain content of someone's diet, you increase the bacteria that we know are producing the really good stuff, the stuff that really gives is very anti-inflammatory and promotes better body weight and all of those things. When you take grains out of people's diets, people have looked at these low-carb diets, put people on a high-protein, low-carb diet, their gut health goes down the toilet, so to speak. I mean, it really does. All of the beneficial bacteria, they start to stop producing the short-chain fatty acids that we know are really important for health, and they start producing all these nasty metabolites that we know are linked to cancer and cardiovascular disease. So one of the worst things that you can do for your health, based on what we know so far, for your gut health, is to remove whole grain fiber out of your diet and to increase protein and reduce carbs. Yes, you might lose weight. And this is the other interesting thing too, and the best way I can describe this is in animals, if you feed them a high protein, low carb diet, yes, they will lose more weight and they will have greater reproductive capacity, but they will die sooner. Okay. So what would you rather be? Really skinny and ripped, or dead, like or alive and thriving,
and thriving and being able to perform mentally and optimally as well. Can we just
and what's ironic is that all of the really good quality long term studies comparing a low fat healthy diet with lots of complex carbohydrates and everything else to these low carbohydrate diets show that over 12 months there's no difference in the benefit to weight. People end up at exactly the same point, but you've just done a whole lot of damage to your health in the meantime.
Yep. Can we just quickly define what is a whole grain?
Yeah, so whole grains are things like, so you whole grain oats, not the quick oats that have been very heavily processed, but whole grain rolled oats like porridge, barley, rye, buckwheat, frika, quinoa, brown rice, whole wheat. These are all whole grain cereals.
Yeah. And I suppose the two key ones there, or you know, some of them are quite unfamiliar to a lot of our listeners, whole grain pasta versus regular white pasta, brown rice versus regular white rice, whole grain seedy bread versus the square stuff. Would that be the three big ones?
Well, they've been the most commonly consumed. But, you know, things like millet and sorghum as well. I mean, when we look at traditional agrarian, you know, people say in Africa, in the Hazda, looking at, you know, having a traditional diet, and you look at their gut health, it's much more diverse. Many, many more of the bacteria that we know are important for producing these, you know, anti-inflammatory short-chain fatty acids. There was a great study that looked at Hazda poo and looked at poo, or looked at poo from people who are living a traditional lifestyle in Africa and people who are African-Americans having their typical Western diet. And they found the gut health were poles apart. The Westerners had terrible, low diversity, low levels of the short-chain fatty acids because their diets were much higher in animal fat and animal protein and much lower in complex carbohydrates. And their markers of bowel cancer risk were much higher. And that was the opposite in the Africans. And then what they do is they swap their diets for 2 weeks. So the poor Africans got a sad diet, we call it, which is the standard American diet, and the African-Americans got the traditional African diet. And the difference in the health profiles of the bowels in that time, just in a two-week period, was really remarkable.
So you can make quick changes to your well-being. This is so encouraging.
Yeah, very, very quick. And it's just do not go down that path of high protein, high animal fat, low carbohydrate diets. I mean, based on everything we know so far, that will have a very, very detrimental impact on your gut, which will affect the health of the rest of your body.
No worries. We are starting to run out of time. But before we finish up, I wanted to do a bit of a 20 questions quick quiz. And I wanted to run through a few fads or ideas and just get a very, very short word or comment on them, both
Much as possible. And, you know, as a scientist, you're always going, well, there's caveats, we don't know these, yep. So I'll do my best.
We don't want any two-handed nutrition here. As best we can you give us a very brief answer to the impact of these on our health and particularly our mental health, especially since a lot of people listening to this, you know, are going through, if they're not going through their own mental ill health challenges, they're dealing with unusual feelings related to lockdown or COVID or whatever. So, you know, we've talked about how what you eat is under your control and you can impact it. So let's just have a chat about a couple of these things. Red meat.
Fine in moderation, but not processed.
What's processed?
Processed is ham, sausages, those sorts of things. And moderation is 2 to 3 serves that are the size of your palm a week.
Dairy.
As far as mental health goes, it's neither good nor bad. The health benefits or problems are yet to be determined.
Coffee.
Fine in moderation, 2 or 3 cups, but not for people who already have a lot of anxiety, then it can be problematic.
Gluten-free.
Really problematic and almost never justified.
Organic.
Nice if you can afford it. Non-essential.
So you're saying that organic's a bit overrated, is it?
It's not so much as overrated, but it's inaccessible for most people because it's very, very expensive. Ideally, everybody would eat organic and every farm would be organic, but that's not realistic to feed a huge global population.
Paleo.
Just based on so many misunderstandings and lack of knowledge.
Keto.
Possibly useful in some very extreme psychiatric, neuropsychiatric conditions, which we're investigating, but for the general population, a disaster.
Sugar in drinks.
To be avoided. Added sugars to be avoided.
Frozen vegetables.
Perfect.
Coconut oil.
Very overrated.
Raw foods.
Sometimes okay, but often cooking can enhance the bioavailability of things.
Gum disease.
Yeah, very interesting one. Certainly linked to depression in a dose-response manner, and we think that's probably got to do with the microbiome, but much more research is needed.
So I read a fascinating book called The Inflamed Mind by Edmund Burke. I think it's Edmund.
Bull, something, yes. I haven't read it yet. I've got it on my Kindle.
It's really good. He basically says that inflammation through the body and the breaking down of the mind-brain axis mind-brain barrier, whatever causes inflammation, whether it's food, trauma, stress, can result in depression. I find that absolutely fascinating. And
well, this is when I talk about the preeminence of the immune system in mental health. It's for that reason. So inflammation, for those who don't know, it's this low-grade chronic activation of the immune system. It's incredibly common in the West because all the things that are so chronic to us, so overweight, lack of exercise, smoking, poor diet, stress, all of these things promote this. One of the big ways we think that this happens is through the gut and from the gut lining not being as healthy as it could. Long involved explanation for that, but basically anything that helps your gut and fibre is going to have a big impact on inflammation.
Fibre helps inflammation. Olive oil.
Oh, it's absolutely central to inflammation.
Olive oil.
Wonderful, as long as it's extra virgin, not the refined stuff.
Supplements, vitamins, minerals, prebiotics, probiotics, all this stuff that you hear about in the millions of products in Chemist Warehouse.
Probiotics quite possibly beneficial based on what we know. As far as mental health goes, very little evidence for them. Maybe for some forms of folate. But for most, and sometimes some fish oil for people who already have a severe disorder, but in general you'd be better off eating sardines.
Sardines, it's the Tim Ferriss food of choice, and I've actually started eating sardines over the last couple of years and absolutely love them. Just on sardines for a minute, you talk about, and it's a common bit of good advice, don't eat food out of a packet. But the exceptions to that are tinned sardines, tinned chickpeas, tinned beans, tinned lentils, pretty much. And that's basically how I try and structure my diet. Have you got anything to add on packets?
There's processed food, which is, you know, we've been processing food forever. So even things like kimchi and sauerkraut, they're a form of processing. Bread, it's a form of processing. It's the ultra-processed foods that we need to watch out for. When they've been literally taken apart and put back together again, Frankenfoods.
Game Changers Netflix documentary, plant-based diet.
Oh, just so full of misinformation and cherry-picked facts. And this is true for most of these types of things on the telly. It's so easy to go through and sound like you know what you're talking about and to cherry-pick evidence and facts. And there will be some truth in amongst all that. But without being a medical researcher, it is very difficult for someone to break that down. So a good thing to do is to follow people on social media who really do a lot to breaking down these bits of misinformation. There's a great guy on Twitter called Kevin Bass, who is a medical student, a PhD, very interesting background in sort of anthropology, has been himself, a victim of virtually every fad diet that's ever been for years and years and years, the paleo, the keto, the whole thing. And he breaks it all down and he recognises the psychology that goes behind all these extreme diets. Having said that, I think that there's a very good argument for veganism from the point of view of the environment and ethical reasons. And I really, I'm a vegetarian for environmental and ethical reasons. I think that the way the mass production industrialised system of animal production is just so awful that I really get why people take that out of their diet. You just have to be really careful to make sure that you have a very carefully balanced diet if you're a vegan, because you will miss key nutrients.
That was going to be my last question. Veganism or vegetarianism? Comments and thoughts.
From a health perspective, definitely vegetarian is better than vegan. But I get that very often people are vegans for ethical reasons, and I really get that.
Yeah. One of the things that I've changed over the last 3 or 4 years, and I actually, looking back, am surprised, not surprised I've been able to do it, because I never predicted that I would become like this. But in my 20s, I was a typical young guy, meat-based diet with, you know, a few vegetables and carbs on the side. And the thing that changed my perspective was, first of all, figuring out how to actually make vegetables good. But this idea of crowding out, I love this idea of crowding out foods. And basically what it was the more I learnt to love lentils, chickpeas, beans, whatever it is, and I literally put them on my plate first, it turned out there wasn't enough room to fit the steak on. And it was just in your book you talk about Richard Thaler and the nudging and the behavioural design stuff, which is what we love at Resilience Agenda. And it wasn't about eliminating that, because then you just want it. It's about finding something that's better or that you prefer and learning to love it. And then just over time, you know, the meat sort of goes on the side. So I'm certainly not a vegetarian and I don't intend to be. But the majority of our meals now are plant-based, and we might have meat once or twice a week, which sounds like, yep, you know, the right guidelines. And the crowding out concept was, I think, the big one for me, and the order that you put on your plate.
And this is the thing too. Like, if you set yourself a really basic fiber goal, which the bare minimum should be like 35 grams a day for you as a bloke, it's impossible to get that without having legumes every day. It's impossible to get that without having your whole grain cereal. So if you go, right, that's my target, and the other thing is diversity, I'm going to mix it up so every day I'm not having the same grain, the same legume, the same nut, then once you do that, there's almost no room for anything else, because you just can't eat that much.
Yeah. A couple of things to summarise all this, because one of the things that I think perpetuates poor eating is the complexity of it. Now, we've gone into a bit of detail here, but and we've also, you know, there's a lot of complexity out there. You write, just learn to love vegetables and legumes. Experiment with simple recipes and try to eat like a peasant. This can be good for your wallet as well as your health. Michael Pollan writes, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. You say, eat whole foods, mostly plants, not too much. And then you say, possibly the most important aim for our long-term health is keeping our blood sugar low and stable by avoiding the intake of added sugars and refined carbohydrates. Do you still stick by that?
Well, certainly when I wrote the book, we knew less about the gut. But they are totally linked. So based on the research evidence for the problem of high blood glucose, just linked to so many diseases, so many chronic diseases, that's still very, very important. And you keep your blood sugar low by having whole grain forms of complex carbohydrates, the good fats, the good proteins, vegetables, those sorts of things. But by doing that, you're also helping the gut. And the evidence that we have so far is from animal studies, but it shows that high blood glucose affects the lining of the gut. When you have what we call this leaky gut, in inverted commas, this is where the inflammation, this is a key source of inflammation, because it means that the immune system, which is so dependent on the gut, is going to not work as well. You get this chronic inflammation, and that then feeds into the risk for virtually every disease. So they're very closely linked, blood glucose and gut health.
In terms of good things to put in and to crowd into our diets, we've talked about a few things. Let's just sum these up. Omega-3s, healthy fats, whole grains, carbs from fiber, fermented foods like yogurt, cutting out sugar, avoiding most packet foods. What would be your top 3 to 4 tips for things to put in for good mental health? I know you're a huge fan of oats, and we love our oats as well, but I haven't quite made it a daily habit yet. But, you know, what are your top 3 to 4 takeaways for people who want to make some small changes now, not by following the same tired advice of, you know, eliminate this and then failing potentially, but putting more good stuff in?
Well, this is why I say focus on plants, more of them and a more diversity. And so people who have a more diverse gut have much better health outcomes. People who have 30 different types of plant foods or more a week have a much more diverse than those who gut than those who have 10 or fewer. Now, 30 a week sounds like a lot. It's not. It's actually really easy to get 30 a day. If you just, you know, for me, if I had, say, oats for breakfast and on top of that I put some crushed nuts and some blueberries, that's 3 just to start with. And then if all the plant foods and the nuts and the seeds. In the afternoon I have walnuts, cashew nuts, almonds as a snack with some fruit. That's 4 different types of plant foods right there. So diversity of plant foods and reducing the junk and processed foods. It's not just the sugar, it's the salt, it's the added fats, it's the trans fats, it's the all of these things that are all really, really noxious to our health.
Can you eat too much fruit? You know, we hear that just yesterday, because I've been researching you for this podcast, Google is now showing me all this, you know, food-related stuff. And I got an ad before a YouTube video yesterday, and I actually watched the whole thing. It was quite interesting. And it's this ripped-looking guy talking about weight loss, but he's like, don't eat more vegetables because, you know, X, Y, and Z, they've got carbs. Don't eat fruit because of the fructose. Don't eat this and that. And then you've got to wait till the end of the 3-minute video, and then you've got to, you know, sign up to his link to find out what it was. And I just found it amusing because this ad clearly is effective. That's why it came to me. It works.
It makes me furious, and it makes me want to weep because they are just doing so much damage. And it's all because they're wanting to either push themselves, their supplements, their diet plan, whatever. There is no, this is the worst common sense, the worst information that you could be putting out there. As far as the fruit thing goes, it goes back to that crowding out thing. If you had 15 pieces of fruit a day, you're less likely then to be having whole grain cereals and legumes and you know, vegetables. So you don't have too much of any one thing, because it will crowd out the other things that you need to be getting that diversity. But fruit is amazing. The food matrix, the nutrients and all of the different compounds, the phytochemicals and the fiber, brilliant little things. But, you know, keep it to 2 or 3 a day so that it doesn't crowd out other things that you should also be eating for health.
Fantastic. Look, where can we learn more about you and your work, and where can people get a hold of your books?
So the book is available in Australia, the UK and Europe. That's Brain Changer. And people can get it through, you know, online. They can order it, or it'll be in some of the bookshops. They can go to the Food and Mood Centre website. We've got lots of very accessible information there. It's designed for the general public, so Food and Mood Centre. We have this amazing free online course. If people Google Food and Mood and Future Learn, or they go to the website, they'll find it. Now, this free online course, we ran it for the first time in November last year, and then again in May, and we've just opened it up again this week in September. And it's attracted so far over 50,000 people enrolled from more than 160 countries around the world. So it's wildly popular and people have really got a lot out of it. And then more recently, just in the last few weeks, we published There's a Zoo in My Poo, which is a super basic, super fun way of understanding about the gut and what you need to feed it. And it's for kids, but it's also for their parents and teachers and grandchildren as well.
Fantastic. Look, we're going to have links to these things in the show notes. And, you know, I've really enjoyed our discussion and it'd be lovely to be able to share your work with our audience as well. Thank you so much for coming on, Felice.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Hadley. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Resilience Agenda Radio. Remember, you can join us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Resilience Agenda website, or your favourite podcasting platform. Feel free to follow us on Facebook and Instagram by searching Resilience Agenda and sign up for occasional updates and strategies to build your mental fitness, www.resilienceagenda.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please follow us so you'll never miss a new episode. Leave us a review online or share Resilience Agenda Radio with your friends so they can learn more about the Mental Fitness Toolkit and hear more from our lineup of world-renowned experts and storytellers. Until next time, I'm Hadley Fisher, and thanks for listening in to Resilience Agenda Radio.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.